this might be great for anybody else, you know, kind of getting started, is get past you. They wouldn't be taking the meeting if they didn't have some sense that you're an okay guy and you know mm-hmm. what you're doing, right? Get past you and get right to the deal as quick as you can. Not close hard, but, you know, people are investing. They see lots of deals, right?
Yep.
And they're busy and they just don't have a lot of time for all the reasons you're such a great guy and they should just take a chance with you. That's great. They know that you're a big part of the deal. They wouldn't be talking to you if not. Tell me how the deal works, right? What's yes. the risk and return? And then especially if we're starting out in the business, you know, do you really, as a young person who may have blind spots, look like the kind of guy that has a lot of blind spots or only a few?
Well, I'm excited to welcome back to the show, my man, Mr. Tom Hoban. How are we doing?
Hey, good, man. How are you, bro?
You know, I just gave you a little narrative and backstory on how things have been going in my world, which has been, you know, a turbulent time, which I know we'll probably dig into at some point today. But I'm excited for kind of our listener today, our, at least when we were talking, because you and I can go for hours on many different directions. When you find somebody that shares common values, is a wise sage like you are, who gives a ton of value, but is also, you know, always doing something big and motivating and challenging and inspiring. I get excited to have these kind of conversations, and I'm wanted our guests to kind of be a part of our catch up. You know, I look at you as a mentor, as a friend, as somebody that's had massive success, but stands for all the right things and goes about it the right way. And so those are the people I always want to learn and grow from myself. And then when I get to offer, you know, I guess a little bit of a sounding board for other people to keep in and get a little taste of your wisdom today, I figured it'd be a great episode and call to record. So might be a little bit different than our traditional style of Millionaire Mindcast podcasting, but I know it's probably going to be 10x the value. And for those that are listening that are real estate investors and, you know, this fun world, the syndication opportunity path of wealth building and, you know, what's out there in the landscape in the real estate investment world and how that's really become available and something that many people can take advantage of, we're going to talk about that today and get some advice from one of the wisest dudes and most successful dudes in that space. So Tom, welcome back in. What the heck has been going on with you, dude?
Well, it's good to see you, man. I'm glad I reached out, and it's just a delight to be on with you, honestly. What the work you're doing and the way you pour out. I became a follower of your podcast, you know, when somebody brought you to my attention, and then you thought maybe I'd have something to offer a year ago when we got on. That was in the middle of COVID when I was cutting my own hair before I grew a beard. And
I was like, dang, dude, you're like the sexiest man on earth now. You know, you look like you ran out of a dumpster back then and we're all rolling out of bed every day. Now you look like you should be on the magazine of GQ.
Well, it's funny. A lot of, you know, we all have our own little, you know, COVID's over when stories, right? And for me, it was when I get back on a basketball court, you know, in a legit pickup game somewhere. And, you know, I'm old enough that I shouldn't be playing, but that was one. And then, you know, I could actually go to a barber and, you know, overindulge myself there in the chair and not worry about it. Right. So a few things. Yeah. No, it's been a great year or so, even though it's been hard on everybody, really. We can't run past this past year and the impacts of school closures on our children and kind of, you know, what there's this still malaise here. It seems to be infecting elements of the country. I'm particularly paying attention to young men right now. They just kind of, you know, low participation rate in the workforce and a lot of kind of interesting things, lower college admissions. So there's all those macro things going on. And in the meantime, mm-hmm. we're trying to, you and I, you know, run real estate businesses. And, for listeners and followers who don't know, I've spent 35 years in commercial real estate up in the Puget Sound, Seattle area, kind of working a property management business that now manages, $5-6 billion worth of apartment, office, you know, self-storage. Back in the day, I'd manage anything that moved, man. I mean, I could tell you stories about managing horse farms and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, but, listen, we're going to have to give people an idea of where this all started for you, too, because there's so many, you know, nuggets of wisdom in that journey of they hear the $5-6 billion worth of real estate, right? And go, okay, there's some for sure experience and winning that has happened along the way.
Yeah, You bet. Yeah, we're fee managers in that setting, right? So that kind of gives you this front row seat to, you know, learn the business when you're young and kind of, you know, watch what works and what doesn't. And then, you know, maybe 15 years ago or so, we, my brother's my business partner, we started investing in the market ourselves so we could really, so we could keep the property management business. Most people kind of don't stay in it as long as we have. We liked it. We love being job creators and the community that we can create through owning a, you know, business that touches that many people. You know, we formed a family office where our mandate is to favorably influence the lives of a million souls. And man, you can touch a lot of people and hopefully in a slightly favorable way, you know, through a property management platform that reaches into, you know, 25,000 households and, you know, a bunch of office and retail space. So that's what that business does. It, we have other people working in it every day with us, doing a great job of running it. And then started that investing thing. And it's interesting. We're super risk averse. We're kind of singles and doubles guys. So when we started jumping into investing, we looked at our own book and then did a bunch of data scrubbing in the markets we were in. So, well, what product type, what geographic area, you know, what strategy, you know, works best here. And, we kind of landed on core plus suburban, you know, fully amenitized kind of 150 unit, you know, to 300 unit apartment buildings would look like the right story for us. And, but they're a lot bigger than we had the money to afford. Right. So we became syndicators very early in our careers. Right. Which
did people even call it that back then?
It's kind of a pejorative, to be honest. It's kind of, you know, syndicator. I don't know.
That just became a marketable title.
Yeah. I think. Cause if you're, cause we hear these things about being a criminal syndicate, you know, and maybe there was a rub off there, but that was something, you know, I mean, we sometimes we just call it direct invest, right? So yep. There's sort of a couple ways to raise money to go buy income properties. One would be to raise a fund. Well, it's pretty tough to do if you haven't done that before. You don't have people in the room that have done it. And we're just operators. Our alpha is management work. Just wake up and try to, you know, run these things well.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's show sponsor. Are you struggling to close deals? Cold outreach can be a slow and brutal process, and in many scenarios, it's just wasting the time of both the buyer and the seller, especially when business owners who are trying to find qualified buyers are using inaccurate and outdated data. But it doesn't have to be this way. With LinkedIn Sales Navigator, your organization can overcome these challenges by leveraging this amazing technology and platform that translates comprehensive, high-quality buyer data into real-time insights and sales. These deeper insights empower sales reps and teams to adopt the habits of top performers, which leads to much better outcomes like building a bigger pipeline with real customers, leading to higher win rates and conversions, and of course, larger deals and paydays all around. We call this deep sales, and LinkedIn has built the first deep sales platform with the next generation of LinkedIn Sales Navigator. Right now, our Millionaire Mindcast family has an amazing opportunity to try LinkedIn Sales Navigator and get a 60-day free trial at linkedin.com/mindcast. That's linkedin.com/mindcast for a 60-day free trial. Let LinkedIn Sales Navigator help you sell like a superstar today. Just go to linkedin.com/mindcast and get started.
And find a little more in them. The other is just, you know, put your own money on the table and go find other people have enough to fill that down payment bucket, you know, match it with some debt and go buy a deal. Right. So That's been the game. I would, you know, probably done a rinse and repeat on 25 or 30 of those over the last 15 years. So pretty experienced. And you were telling a story, one of your podcasts that got my attention, you know, about how those things can kind of go rocky. In fact, might be interesting to talk about, you know, how, you know, for maybe some of our, newer to commercial real estate, you know, followers and whatnot, you know, I've learned a lot. I mentor a lot of other people and care a lot about success. And boy, man, if I could help them avoid a couple of, you know, those pitfalls, that'd be great. That'd be a fun thing to kind of break down.
Well, you don't, who wants to talk about their losses, right? Like in the moment when you're going through it, it sucks. Oh, and yeah. it's humbling. Sometimes it can feel embarrassing. Sometimes it can be depressing, frustrating, but all of those in hindsight, when you really look back in kind of the rearview mirror of how they played out, are usually the inflection points of taking you to a better version of yourself, a a better version of opportunities or leading you on a path of bigger and better opportunities. And you kind of have to go through that suckiness, that shitty moment, you know, or season to kind of get there, right? But when you're still whole and you learned and gained, you know, wisdom from it, it gives you the ability to kind of feel some confidence when you hear other people talking about it, being like, oh yeah, I got plenty of those too. So I thought that when you mentioned that, it would be such a great idea, because, you know, oftentimes people just talk about the highlight wins all the time. And I was going through what I thought was going to be, you know, doubling our, it was going to take our company revenue between these three hotels, you know, from about a little over three to close to seven, within a, you know, 12 and a half month, 14 month timeframe. So you go from thinking you're going to double, your revenue and your company essentially, and your keys and, you know, our operations and getting scale and kind of getting past this like messy middle of just the grind and the hustle of not being at full, you know, scale and being able to run what feels like a real company, to then the deal hit roadblocks and challenges. And, you know, the economy, our bank, when they started raising rates, you know, our bank retraded us on LTV. They raised the rate alongside, you know, everybody else kind of got spooked, and it felt like we were going through this deal of what felt like check every single box hotel right next door to the other, one of the other, you know, three hotels that I own up there. It would have doubled our team. It had commercial laundry facilities. It had everything we wanted, commercial core deal financially penciled. And then all of a sudden that happened. And then, you know, we had to essentially either bring another $2.5 million to the table to cover that delta of what, you know, the difference was, or, you know, it was a dead deal. And we were already working with a pretty challenging, savvy seller, shrewd seller, not a lot of wiggle room with this guy, knew he had a great asset, ran it really, really well, strong operator. And, you know, he had, I think, five or six other hotels that were all just $15 to $30 million hotels, and got him to carry back the $2.5 million difference. So I was like, cool, we're back on track. Obviously, the economics of the deal and, you know, the shift in capital that needed to be brought to the table, and obviously what, you know, that financial change added to the portfolio or the pro forma, it made the deal a little bit thinner. It spooked out the equity partner that I had, who ultimately was, we were 50-50 on the asset. So it was one equity partner that was going to be contributing that equity. So I had all my eggs in this one basket. That was a learning lesson, you know, because when we got to the closing table with all those things that had happened, still got the deal in terms of the loan approved, and we got the bank to, you know, sign off on everything. We're getting ready to move to docs and close. Got the seller to carry back that additional debt in second position. We'd fought tooth and nail for this deal. Everything that could have derailed it, almost derailed it. We got there, and the equity partner got cold feet, said he didn't want to do the deal. And that was one of those moments where you get so deflated, right? You do it, you feel like you do everything right. And sometimes, you know, every deal is an ordeal, has an ordeal, and stuff comes up. So how do you protect on those downsides, like from all of the deals you've been in and out of, some of those things that are like, I feel like I did everything in my control and I still lost, you know, what do you, what do you see from your side that I could have done better there or thought about differently in terms of maybe building a moat for that deal to get done still?
Yeah. It's funny. Cause I, the very first deal I got on, it was a 33 unit apartment building. I had a pretty significant equity partner. We needed, you know, you're dealing with OPM, other people's money. That just, you know, you gotta,
when you don't have it at that scale yet, you're dealing with other people's
money.
And
actually,
right?
In the model we have today, even though, you know, we probably could self-fund a lot of our deals, we prefer this model now. Actually, it's kind of neat because now we're serving people, you know, bringing them a product that they need and helping other people out. So I kind of flipped my thinking on that. But initially, you know, we're young. We don't know what we're doing. I'm chasing this deal. This guy's locked up and he kind of pulled out last minute, killed the deal too. And I lost, you know, my $30,000.
Yeah, we walked away from
deposit. Yeah, it's painful. That was 30 grand. I didn't have, you know, time to just burn very easily, you know, so you never have much of, you know,
every dollar matters, right? Yeah. You know?
That was hard. You know, it's expensive lessons, right? But anyway, he brought me in and he said, I got a bailout on you. And I knew he felt bad about it, but he had to do it. He had some reasons to do it that, mm-hmm. you know, that, and I gave him the whole, but you promised and you signed and, you know, but what am I going to, you know, what am I going to do?
You know, yeah. What are you going
to
do?
Try to die on this hill and still lose and never win him back or turn him into an investor. And I just said, why? And he said, well, things have gone pretty well for you so far in your career. And I'm only 28, 29 years old. And I said, yeah, they've gone pretty well, I guess, you know? And he says, okay, great. That's your problem. He said, I want you to come back and see me after you've had your ass kicked 3 times. Amen it. And an older guy, he'd been around. And so I'm kind of upset and everything. But I leave. Anyway, 5 years later, I come back after 3 major ass kickings. And now I get it, right? So what he's teaching you and what, you know, these experiences teach us is that we have blind spots, especially as we're building our career. No matter how much help we have from great mentors and advisors and our natural curiosity, those things all help and they reduce the number of blind spots we have. But we're going to get some ass kickings no matter how hard we try. So in fact, I'll give you a couple examples of how they've happened to us. And then maybe we could spend some time talking about how to reduce the risk of those. Right. Because mm-hmm. now, you know, there's some new risk, like when interest rates run on, really, this is all what happened to you is just a direct result of interest rates running on you. Well, you know, I started in the business in 1984 out of college when interest rates were 18%. I'm aware that they can be very high. In fact, 5% doesn't seem that high to me today, right? But they got to go from really low to there. And when things move, then, you know, banks get nervous and LTVs change. And then that changes the equity requirement, which now squeezes down your return because you got to pay for that second deed of trust that you stuck in there. And that can kind of tweak things up. Okay. So interest rate movement, you know, causes me problems, no longer a blind spot. But the deals that we've had, you know, they haven't been horrible outcomes. You know, maybe we didn't make money, but we didn't lose money, you mm-hmm. know, or, you know, we walked away from a deal and lost our deposit, but, you know, we never actually got into the deal. We owned an apartment building not far from the largest Boeing plant in the country, which is in Everett, Washington, a little north of Seattle. And there's a, you know, some apartments down the street, a whole bunch of them. And you imagine they're full of, you know, Boeing workers, right? Mm-hmm. Probably a third of the tenant base is. Well, when the terrorists on 9/11, interesting, we're talking about this the day after that mm-hmm. tragic anniversary, because they used airplanes to attack, everybody froze up and didn't want to fly. And contracts between airlines and, well, many contracts, but between the airlines and Boeing have carve outs for riot and war and all these things, and they can cancel their orders without any penalty. And they did. They're like, oh, we don't know if anybody's even going to get on an airplane again, right? Looks like it's pretty scary right now. So Boeing just sends pink slips out to everybody and they all just move back to Oklahoma or wherever they're from. And, you know, my building's a third empty, like in a matter of 6 weeks. And that's it. You know, now you're out of whack with your loan covenants and all. So anyway, fast forward, right? So now I got to think about like my risk now is if terrorists use airplanes to do no, actually what I learned is that I should never have a concentration of tenants employed by a single employer over some percentage.
And that's been diversity.
Baked, yeah, it's been baked into our underwriting ever since. I think it's 15% max is the most we'll take. So for example, that's cut us out of student housing. We won't touch it. There's all kinds of opportunities in student housing. A lot of it looks really good. Mm-hmm. But the reality is you're feeding off a single employer who, by the way, could be your top competitor if they start building student housing on campus and they're, you know, they've got a strong enough endowment to do that. They've got reasons to do it because as crime goes up, they tend to kind of want to pull their kids in closer to campus. And yep. So the off-campus housing slips. So there's one, right? So, you know, other, you know, lessons have just been things around the people side of it, right? Maybe we had an investor we thought was locked up, but we didn't, maybe, you know, we went on handshakes too long. And then when it came down to actually signing papers, you know, he didn't check off with his team or his accountant or the other members of his LLC. And so he made a promise he couldn't keep. We didn't know that. We thought he'd checked all those boxes, all that kind of stuff, right?
Yep.
So the people side, definitely you got to, you know, get savvy with that. And then interest rates, thankfully, we haven't had too much trouble with it. We expect there to be some wiggle, not as much as we've had the last 6 months. But, you know, when that cause happens, we know what the effects are. Now you do. But that's just because I happen to have been around long enough to see what happens in those environments.
Yep.
Now, so there's, you know, it's called, you know, the mistakes you make, Cash. A lot of times in the front end is where this all can kind of happen, right? So one of your followers might be, you know, thinking, well, I'm going to go buy this deal. I need some other investors. So, you know, he organizes everything into an LLC. He's going to tuck some LPs in behind him. And he's got, you know, a little bit of friends and family over here. And then he's got to go cold and talk to a bunch of other people. In fact, actually, one of my sons is doing that now. He's out doing his own real estate development. And,
nice.
He didn't want any help from me, so that's fine. And he's his own man. And so I said, well, you know, good luck going walking out cold at 28 years old on your first or second deal, you know, and see how, and he did. He raised, you know, quite a bit actually from, you know, about 10 different people. And so the first thing he learned, and this might be great for anybody else, you know, kind of getting started, is get past you. They wouldn't be taking the meeting if they didn't have some sense of that you're an okay guy and you know mm-hmm. what you're doing, right? Get past you. And get right to the deal as quick as you can. Not close hard, but, you know, people have lots, you know, people are investing in they see lots of deals, right?
Yeah.
And they're busy and they just don't have a lot of time for all the reasons you're such a great guy and they should just take a chance with you. That's great. They know that you're a big part of the deal. They wouldn't be talking to you if not. Tell me how the deal works, right? What's the risk and return? And then especially if we're starting out in the business, you know, do you really, as a young person who may have blind spots, look like the kind of guy that has a lot of blind spots or only a few?
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's show sponsor.
Our sponsor today is Uplift Desks, creators of the best office furniture designed to help you work better and live healthier. Visit UpliftDesk.com/Mindcast for 5% off your order. And if you sit all day while you work and you've never tried a desk that can transition between sitting and standing, this is a complete game changer for you. My standing desk is by Uplift Desk. It's what I use every day to record the show, to do my office work. And I gotta say, the transition from sitting all day to standing while I work at various times throughout the day has really made a noticeable difference. When I'm standing, I notice that my energy is up. I'm way more focused and productive. I'm an alert. And I even have a little standing treadmill under my desk now, which allows me to get some extra steps in while plugging away on calls and work. It keeps the blood flowing throughout the day, which we all know can reduce all types of inflammation, different health risks, repetitive strain. And I noticed that my posture has drastically improved since switching to Uplift Desk as well, because I'm not hunched over a computer all day. And while there's a lot of options out there, the reason I chose Uplift Desk is because of the quality. It doesn't wobble, it's completely stable, it's built to last. And you can tell based on the materials that they use, and they are customizable too. Uplift Desk lets you build your custom dream desk by choosing from over 100 desktop choices and hundreds of accessories so you can build the perfect workspace for yourself using their fun-to-use desk configurator. Now, once you have your desk designed and ordered, they ship the same day. You get free shipping. They do free returns with free return shipping. And the best part is they have an industry-leading 15-year warranty that covers the complete desk, which to me was a big deal. And it shows that they stand behind their product. Now to get yours, go to UpliftDesk.com/Mindcast for 5% off your order. That's UpliftDesk.com/Mindcast to get 5% off your entire order.
I was going to say, how do you overcome that newness to kind of like looking to take that next step up? You know,
well, this is why it's so like what you do. You actually have wisdom because you hang around other people who have wisdom, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, just because we have wisdom from past history doesn't mean all of it will apply to the future. So you know, somebody says, well, yeah, this is the way you do it. Oh, you got to read this book. This guy's got to, yeah. Okay, fine. I got to live in this world today and tomorrow. So I'm going to do it my way, but I'm going to take that under advisement. That's a big way. You know, do you have the kind of people around you who have enough wisdom to help guide you? And then do you look like you're smart enough and have enough critical thinking skills and any kind of track record to prove that you can take that stuff in, but you're not just, you know, monkey see, monkey do, right? You've got some discernment in you and you can understand how it goes. Well, a big thing that I know when we're evaluating other people's deals as an LP, so now they're coming to pitch me from time to time, right?
Yep.
I'm really looking for their resilience, this ability. You've just been through this, you know, you had some family losses, you know, your poor dog had passed, you know, he had a deal that was, you know, that's what an ass kicking looked like. It comes in a chunk, right? and you know, yes. What are you made of?
Yeah.
You have any resilience? And so there's no formula to figure out what someone's resilience quotient is, but, you know, especially in, you know, real estate deals have their highs and lows, but there's some elements of them that are kind of predictable. There's no, you know, like IP and there's no patent and there's, you know, it's like these VC plays are the kind of thing where sometimes there are people who can start up businesses who will just will them to success somehow. Right. So, you know, now you can stay in them too long and keep losing people money if there's no there, but I do care. I think a lot of success in syndicating real estate deals, because a lot of times we're holding them for a chunk of time and, you know, are you here for the long haul? Can I trust you to do good work? And are you tough enough to get through the tough times and not lay around and wallow and blame others and all that? You know, it's the way my dad, who's, we're Irish Catholic, and my dad's so proud of it. He's still around, his late 80s, you know, Korean War era guy, you know, the whole tough, you know, kind of reminds me of Clint Eastwood.
I would love to be at your Thanksgiving dinner table and hear some of the stories of your pops.
Yeah, we're Irish, so you're never quite sure if they're all true, you know. That's how we Irish go, you know. If you need a stronger punchline at the end, you know, it's okay to color a story a little if you're Irish. But no, he would say, you know, to me and my younger brother, you know, I don't know if you guys are going to be able to make it in your 20s in business, but you do possess one advantage. You're Irish. And the one thing about Irish is they get their ass kicked a lot. They get right back up and run right into the fight. Right. So that was his sort of way of saying, you know, be resilient. Don't lay on the ground very long. It's like football. You know, you get your hat knocked off, you know, pick your hat up, get back in the huddle, even if you're a little stung, you know, and just go. And I do think that matters in when you're syndicating real estate deals. I think it's something that LPs look for, is that resilience quotient, mostly because real estate is really kind of an operating business full of lots of tedious deals that are details that have to be organized in a manner toward a common goal. And you got to really watch, it's like running a retail business. You got to really watch the details. Hotel, even more so, right? You got all this, you know, ratings you got to watch, and you got hotel customers you got to keep
day.
There's a lot of stuff going on there.
Yep.
You have it to get through the tough times when things don't go well, whether they're knocking you down at home or they're, you know, hitting you in the face in the deal. You got to get through those tough times and get through them quick. That might be actually more important than, you know, how well can you calculate the return on investment after my pref?
Yeah. You know? Well, I think a lot of people get hung up on that piece too, right? Where they have the grit and the stamina and the determination, but they get hung up on the fact that they think they need to understand and be the expert in the money or the financial modeling side of it. How do you suggest newer people coming into this space? And this can be applied to any business or any kind of, you know, pursuit of a new business or goal or passion. How do they overcome that initial, you know, hurdle mentally of structuring and proceeding forward and executing with the plan and just getting out of their own way?
Yeah, well, whether you advertise that as part of who you are or they're just there, but the more experience and wisdom you can surround yourself with to guide you along the way, the better your chances are of, you know, avoiding big pitfalls. But there are some realities that are unavoidable. So let's just take an example of a deal. You're going to buy a 50-unit apartment building or office building or something. You know, there's going to be a lender involved. We need leverage to make these work. So let's start with, let's not over leverage, but let's not under leverage the deal, right? We need leverage. We can't find a return. So kind of find that sweet spot. And so when things go really bad, it's the over leveraged deals that fall out of their loan covenants. Now you got to contribute more equity. Now you got the one thing you don't ever want to do, if you can ever avoid it, is go to your investors for a cash call. That's the beginning of the end in many cases, right? So, you know, reduce the risk of that by getting some sensible leverage on it. You know, and everybody kind of has their own number. Our magic spot is kind of 67-68% kind of works for these apartment buildings we buy. So, and then have a deep appreciation if you're young and you're moving forward. Do the research to figure out what it's going to take to secure a legit loan on this thing and what that guarantor's balance sheet needs to look like. Because you probably are walking in the door without it, and you're going to need to drag somebody else in. Then have a deep respect for the risk that they're taking. Mm. We've had a long, really good run here since the real estate crash, not a lot of loan defaults and blood in the water, you know, but those of us have been through an S&L crisis and, you know, high interest rate environment and the crash and all that. We know what guarantor risk really looks like, right? So find a guarantor whose balance sheet can stand tall and then respect them in that environment so that they're compensated some way. If they're not already an investor, you know, they get some extra pop of some kind for stepping in and co-signing on that loan as the guarantor. And I'm sure, you know, most of the people sophisticated enough to go buy a real estate deal know this, but all guarantors are not alike, you know. And I my first job out of college was at a bank, and it was right in the middle of the S&L crisis. So unfortunately, I didn't get to wake up and make many loans to people doing really well. I spent a lot of time over in the special assets section because I was a, you know, piece of meat fresh out of college, and I could count. You know, helping the bank figure out, you know, how hard should we start squeezing these borrows before we foreclose on assets? And if they're personally guaranteed loans, then the first thing you do is go to the one guarantor. If there's, you know, two or three of them in there that's got the most liquidity and the strongest balance sheet, go get relief there. I mean, you only have so many dollars to spend on your legal team to go sue people to try to, you know, get them to perform on their loan. And so just recognize that, you know, if you're young and you're getting started and you're, hey, I'm standing tall in there as a guarantor, I got all my stuff on line too. It doesn't really mean that much if things go bad. The bank's going to go where they can get the most relief. So the heavy on the guarantee is an important one to understand and maybe appreciate and respect in the room until you're in a position where to do that yourself. Because that's the GP's obligation.
So what about like a 10 or a, you know, $15 million purchase? Would, you know, or what maybe is a good rule of thumb for a balance sheet guarantor for every tier of purchasing power?
Are you interested in boosting your income by an extra $50,000 this year? If so, you're going to love what I've got in store for you. I am beyond excited to officially announce an incredible opportunity to join me in my exclusive mastermind, which will include myself and 25 other hand-selected investors who are actively pursuing commercial real estate in 2024 and want to be held accountable to making sure they buy their first or their next commercial real estate investment property that will net them a minimum of $50,000 a year. This mastermind group will not only teach you how to do that, how to find, how to analyze, how to structure and buy these types of commercial real estate investment properties, but you'll also have an opportunity to be a part of an intimate group of high achievers that are going to take your network and your resources to a whole nother level. But here's the catch. Like I mentioned before, this is exclusive. We're only selecting 25 ambitious individuals for our founding members group who are serious and ready to take that next step in their commercial real estate investing journey. So if you are ready to increase your passive income by at least $50,000 in the next year with commercial real estate investing, then this is your moment. These spaces are gonna fill up fast. And trust me, this is the one and only time to be a founding member, which comes with some pretty special benefits. So head over to myfirst50k.com and submit your application now. Again, that's myfirst50k.com. You can head over there, check out the program, see everything that it entails, submit your application to join, and I can't wait to connect with you soon.
I wish I had good memory on those. You know, there's, you know, banks have really clear stuff on the ratios and the liquidity requirements. They really look for liquidity. You know, what kind of stock portfolio do you have? You might have a little cash around. A lot of times it'll help if you move your business, you know, your banking relationships over to them if it's a commercial bank. And, you know, when you get up to these kind of, now you get up to kind of non-recourse, now you've got a little less risk on the guarantee, except for what they call the carve-outs for really bad behavior, you know, fraud, you know, really bad stuff that you know if you're doing it. It's not accidental. It's usually your own doing.
So
non-recourse is a different animal entirely, but they'll look in deep to the liquidity and So, you know, I would think, you know, it'd be tough to probably, you know, secure a loan of 10 to 15 million if you didn't have a guarantor that had, you know, at least 10% of that in just pure liquidity and maybe a balance sheet that could stand up to, you know, at least half of that or so. The bank's going to do, I probably sound like I'm way out over my skis if there's a banker listening, but, you know, the bank's going to figure, you know, we have a default situation here. But for the borrower to stay in the seat, that's the best thing for them. They don't actually want the asset back through a foreclosure. That costs them a lot of money and it tends not to work out because there's usually, you know, a problem in the market. You don't want to sell into a bad market.
Yep.
But, you know, 50% of the loan, if the borrower had to save it, and they had enough cash and some other assets they could liquidate, they were uncorrelated to the real estate deal they're in, you know, I feel pretty good about that. So I'm guessing that that's kind of what the balance sheets need to look like to stand up to that kind of thing. And then they're going to ask for any investors, typically, you've experienced this too. I mean, they're going to typically ask any individual LP that's got more than maybe 20% position in the total equity pool, they'll probably ask them to step in with a guarantee too.
Mm-hmm.
So keep that in mind as you're out raising capital. You know, maybe you don't want anybody else to, you know, that's not what the LP signed up for, was to, you know, also take on a bunch of guarantee risk.
Yes.
Maybe you need to go out the door recognizing that, you know, I can't just rely on one heavy and a couple small ones here. I got to find a bunch of people, you know, if I'm raising, you know, $5 million, I can't have anybody over, you know, say 20% of that. So that's, you know, that's something to think about too. And then there's just this reality in the marketplace of LPs, you know, private high net worth individuals, the kind of people you might run into through, you know, networks and things like that. Not big private equity pooled, you know, funds and things like that, but the kind of people that kind of get people like me started, you know, that are just sort of, you know, handful of people in town, you know, they're kind of in that, you know, $100,000 to $500,000 range anyway.
Yep.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, and they all know somebody. That's it. That's if everybody wants to, what is that thing? You know, like you send your kids to this school and you're all in and you think it's the best and you want everybody else to send their kids to that school or sign up for this soccer team or whatever, because whatever I'm doing must be, you know, it's validated if everybody else does it. People actually do that in investing too. You know, I'm in with Matt on this thing over here, and they'll tell other people if you make room for them, invite them in. That can help. Yep.
There's a new deal that has kind of come across my plate, so I figured this would be a good one to talk about with a couple of people, because if you're somebody that gets a great deal, right, and you are punching above your, you know, your weight class, there's ways that you're going to have to creatively think about keeping yourself in the deal and structuring it in a way that makes sense to get the deal done, right? Until you get to Tom's stage where you've got all the punching power that you need to get these deals done, right? And so if somebody's got an opportunity, and I'll just talk about the one that I've got, a buddy of mine, Houston operator, strong operator, already has, you know, a good chunk of real estate. Doing kind of honestly reminds me of your model, you know, probably when you were first starting out. He's got, you know, 4 or 5 apartment complexes, a couple hundred doors in Houston, property manages for some other groups as well, and got a great opportunity in the nicest zip code in all of Houston. 206 units, going to be about a $5.5 million cap raise, you know, strong area, A location, out of state owner that's owned it for 30 years and has just barely done enough to kind of have it printing some cash for him passively, but an absentee owner. So it's a home run deal from at least the financial modeling that I'm looking at and going, all right, well, you know, whether you're getting in on the deal as a GP, based on all the different ways to structure things, what for people that are trying to insert themselves into deals or coming across opportunities are good ways that you've seen for people in those positions that can't do it all by themselves to structure the deal to be in the game? Because that's ultimately what you want over the long term until you can take it all down by yourself, right?
Yeah. Yeah. The line of people is so long that have come across a deal they like. They tie it up, and the clock's ticking. And, you know, when you're a buyer in today's market, you don't have a lot of time, you know. Land deals, you have time, but, you know, you're buying a straight over tackle apartment deal, you got to move fast, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing to be thinking is, if I don't know where that 5 million equity raise is, if I don't have probably about 8 million that people have told me, you know, when I add it all up, all the different people have said, yeah, I'll invest. If you get a deal that looks and smells like this, let me know. And yeah, I can turn around quickly and I'll do, you know, one, two or three of those with you. That's kind of what, you know, that's, it's really a pledge, right?
Yep.
We're really going around getting pledges from people. And then they still have some discretion, you know, we show it to them. So we sort of oversell the parking lot or we oversell the flight, right? We're kind of out there trying to stir up enough interest that we have, you know, more capital saying, yeah, you get a deal that looks like that, show it to me. Because, you know, some people just have already deployed their capital or they can't move right then or they don't like the deal or whatever.
Yep.
So, you know, we might give them, back in when we're doing just direct invest, we might give them three strikes and then we'll stop, you know, considering them real.
Yep.
You know, if they pass in the three deals in a row,
makes sense.
Don't do anything. Okay, fine. Yeah. You're not real. But you know, let's just say most of them line up. So the first thing to do on that, you know, if I got to make sure that I have already done the homework. Because if you get the deal and then you want to go suddenly raise 5 million, this isn't you, but this is the mistake I see people make in this business all the time is, hey, I got to raise $5 million really quick for this awesome deal. Well, dude, you know, now you got to go to the buckets of money that are laying around waiting for that. They're going to extract a lot from you. You're probably going to wind up, if you don't have the pledges sort of in place and,
yep,
and kind of oversold, you know, because not everybody's going to commit when you're ready to go. You're probably going to wind up with a JV model where you bring in, you know, you go to the people already have assembled all those people. They put them into a fund and they, you know, put out what their mandate is. And they say, hey, we're happy being LPs under, you know, really good operators. And they're advertising themselves out there. They're going to take more of the action. They're going to want some control. They're going to reach up into that GP and ask for some control, but they've done all the work. They've done all the work to raise the capital and they got the mandate and they got the team in place and, you know, they know what they want and they just go hunting. And so that's not bad. It's not a bad thing.
And is that one check writer?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's, right?
Yeah. A lot of times they'll want to see you in. I mean, I've ever seen anybody ever do a deal unless, you know, the promoter himself had some skin in the deal. They could take down 90% of it or so. Yeah, that happens all the time. And you know, typically we call it a JV model because now they're really, instead of a pure LP, you know, they're kind of an LP plus, right? Yeah, they're kind of in there. Well, sometimes they don't want to be a co-GP, they want to be an LP, but they've got some governing rights where they can kind of crawl up into the GP and tell you when you can and can't sell. And you know, they want to be at table when you refinance, and then they've got eyeballs on you. They're auditing you all the time, make sure you behave because most of the money is theirs, right? So,
yep.
And those are all rights that typically LPs have. If you syndicated that 5 million out to, you know, 20 other people, you know, they have a lot of those rights, but they might not have, say, the right to decide when to sell it, right?
Yeah. What are the structure of kind of LPGP? Any promotes there? What would, you know, kind of, because I'll give you a little bit more color on this one. So, most of the comps on this one in the area are 90 to 130 a door. And this deal is locked up at about 70 a door. I think they're about 75% of where rents conservatively could be. So there's a big rent growth, even with rents cooling down and softening conservatively.
Not unusual for a long-term owner who's just cash flow oriented.
Yeah. Yeah,
hasn't needed to push market.
Exactly.
Yeah, actually, when we manage for people like that, that's the strategy. Is to, let's just be about 5-10% under everybody else's number so we stay full and we just get cash flow and thing, right? So I totally get it. Okay.
Yep.
So he's leaving a little bit on the table, probably intentionally so.
Yep. And he ultimately is, you know, flexible on timing because he's kind of working, figuring out what his thoughts are. So there's some options there. But yeah, so looking at that deal, you know, how would you structure and take that out? 80-20, 70-30, promote schedules, you know.
I've seen all kinds of different models. At the end of the day, you know, when you if you bought it and you held it for 5 to 10 years and you took all the proceeds out at the back end when you close the LLC down and send all the dollars out, it almost always winds up about kind of 80-20, you know, investor. The promote position is about kind of pencils out to about 20. Whether you put in prefs and ladders or you kind of do a straight 80-20 split or 85-15 or some other, sometimes we'll do a different split on the equity that will be distributed when the thing's sold at the end than we will on the cash flow that comes out. You know, we can maybe try different split structures to, you know, generate more cash flow. So be a little more generous as the promoter, generous to the investors on the cash flow piece.
Yeah, I think he was wanting to structure it where, as he's done on his previous ones, no pref, just all capital is returned to the investor first.
Yeah, yeah, and there's kind of some nuances to that. At the back end, when we sell the deal, the first thing we do is we make sure the investors, when we divide everything up under whatever the promote structures are, the first thing we have to do is make sure the investors get all their original capital back, right? We don't get to participate in anything unless at least that has happened. Yep. And then we get to participate, right? So they almost have, we call it in the business, a look back provision, right? So there's a function that's almost always there, the look back that says that, you know, that we don't get to participate till you get your original investment back. But it's not necessarily the case that you have to get all your money back along the way through the cash flow experience and all the way at the back end before we get to touch any of it as the promoter. In fact, if I'm an investor in a deal, I see something like that. First thing I'm thinking is the promoter is going to want to sell this thing quickly because all of his return is captured in the equity.
Not incentivized or taken care of along the way. There's got to be some. So he's got a structure where he's getting some coins put in the slot machine along the way.
There's those fee structures, right?
As you alluded to earlier. And maybe you can give a little color or context on your guys' strategy in terms of how you structure your fees to make sure you guys are taken care of along the way and how that doesn't necessarily require you to be as aggressive on the split structure because you're collecting a good chunk along the way, right?
Yeah. Well, we're probably a little unusual because we had a an income from our property management company, the little engine that could over there always. So, you know, we didn't look at the investment program that we created and kind of became its own big monster. We didn't look at it as a place to really, you know, for my brother and I, we were the kind of the heavies in it initially. We weren't looking at it as a place to earn fee income. We already had good incomes coming from the other business. So ours is a little different. We're a little lighter on the fees. We chose strategically to not be brokers. We wanted the brokerage community highly incentivized to bring us deals. And if we had our hand out to participate in the brokerage fee, we thought maybe they'd, you know, it's not really a fully transparent market. You don't really know why the other guy got the deal when your prices were kind of the same. But, you know, if we were trying to participate in the brokerage fees and he wasn't, maybe that was the tiebreaker.
Yep.
So we got out of that. And so acquisitions fees can... It typically market is right around 1% of the purchase price would spill into the promoter just to pay the bills. And that's pretty, you know, you need something to pay the bills. You need, you know, you got an acquisition team that's probably all, you know, very incentive oriented and bonus oriented based on performance and getting the deal in the door. You got to juice them up. So most LPs are comfortable with something like that. The asset management fees along the way vary a lot. It depends on the program and the promoter themselves. You know, we were always vertically integrated, so we weren't trying to make much money on the asset management fee, you know, month to month. We might have charged 1% of the gross income we collected on the apartment buildings on top of the management fee just to pay for the asset management work, but not much more than that. And then there might be a refinance fee. Sometimes people will do that if there's the work to do, which, you know, create a distribution experience usually for the investors. So like, okay, well, there's some work to do there. There is a lot of underwriting and all that, as you know. And sometimes people charge, you know, half a percentage point or something like that, you know, 500 bips for that trouble if they do it themselves. And then maybe another, you know, half a point to 1% disposition fee at the back end for, again, the work to make sure everything is done right at the back end if we're selling it. So there's some fee income in there. Honestly, being a promoter is skinny on fees. It's a hard business to go into and live on the fee income. It helps to be involved in some other things at the same time. So at least for us, it was property management. I know a lot of people are already in development. There's some development fees sometimes when they buy these things, they do a value add or they're building ground up. And then there's sort of this maturation experience that they might have that kind of matches what something like the one in Houston you're looking at. So, you know, so it's not a fee rich business. It can be, in fact, but, it's one of the things that investors new to us will quickly look for, you know, are you guys feeing this thing up? And, you know, a lot of ways people can hide fees and stuff. And we don't, but again, we always had the luxury of some other places to go for that. But that's something for, you know, younger promoters to think about. Do I want to be a broker? And will that, mm-hmm. you know, poison, you know, the market or incentivize people or disincentivize them to bring me deals is one. That's a tough one because there's some good money in that that does pay the bills. And then, you know, if you measure these acquisitions, that's what starts driving you to these larger deals. You know, 1% of a $3 million deal, you know, it's not going to put anybody through school.
Yep.
But a much bigger deal now, it starts to get interesting. But, you know, you can underfee yourself too. I would say to anybody in this business getting going, don't undersell what you should be charging. This is a sophisticated activity that requires good, solid people that need to be incentivized and Absolutely. Rewarded well to do it well, especially if you're offering long-term deals, right? Because one of the things they have to be able to, LP has to be able to see in there is, are you guys going to be around in 10 years? You know, you're asking me
stamina.
To stick. Yeah, well, there's all those resilience issues that we talked about, stamina, grit.
How do you assess that?
Do you even look like you're going to be here? Like, are you, you know, what's your incentive to stick around, right?
Yeah. I was going to say, how do you assess that? How does somebody display that to a potential, you know, capital partner or LP, you know, really selling yourself? You talked about your son, right? You know, and some of the lessons that he learned and some of the things that he successfully was able to do as a 28-year-old going out and syndicating real estate, right? I mean, nowadays, the beauty is there's no lack of access to information, and whatever you decide is your barrier of entry is your barrier of entry based on your mindset around where your barrier of entry is at. But there are absolute real physical hurdles that you got to overcome, oftentimes around financing experience, right? A lot of the kind of variables you're talking about and being that GP. How do you sell yourself on those things? How do you sell your deal and sell your brand, who you are, to, you know, capital partners?
Yeah, well, just for what it's worth, you know, I'm still punching above my weight. You're never not punching above your weight. You know, it's just $5 billion
worth of assets, and is it because you're always going after something bigger?
It's not because I have that problem. Like we don't live lavishly. We don't want all that stuff. Personally, you know, there's not a lot of that energy driving this thing. We're not trying to, you know, I'm sure we have egos, but you know, we you know, they've been well fed that we don't need, mm-hmm. you know, we don't need a lot of attention for, you know, now you got to say, well, really? So you're punching above your weight. Well, what happens? As our business has matured, we start to look, you know, my brother and I in our 50s, you know, we start to look, you know, reasonably successful, and people are making these 7 to 10 year bets on us, and they're kind of going, well, you know, you're going to be about 70 by the time this thing matures, you know, you look like you're getting close to out to pasture. So that's kind of a reality, you know, that we have to face. And so the reason we're punching above our weight is that we've attracted people in their 40s to come work for us, in 30s and 20s, mm-hmm. you know, so we have talent that looks like it'll outlast us. Now, we still think we're going to be doing this forever because it's a blast, and
yeah.
serving other people by helping them get into deals that, you know, we like enough to put a lot of our, you know, skin into, you know, and it's pretty low risk and they're pretty predictable and, you know, they do pretty well. But yeah, but I mean, you have to have the apparatus to do the grind. They know where I'm not in there, you know, painting apartments anymore. So who's doing that, right? So when I was young, that's what I sold. Sean and I are going to do everything. We're going to touch every damn piece of this thing. We'll be out here crawling over this thing. My son, that's one of his pitches. Look, I'm young. I got all this wisdom around me. I kind of grew up in the business. I studied entrepreneurship here. I went to this great college there. I did, you know, I worked in real estate development for a great company and won some awards and all this, you know, hand waving, great stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. But on this deal, this thing, the one thing you know is that I got nothing else in my life but to make that thing successful. So mm-hmm. he's selling what I sold when I was young. We also, I'm selling you the 24/7, I'll work, outwork the old guy. Right?
Yeah.
And over here, I'm one of these guys. I'm like an old guy now. The other kind of going, oh, I don't know if you're going to be around 10 years. So I've got to build a different story to make sure it looks like I've got a strong succession plan. So we're punching above our weight because how could I attract these young, awesome people to come in and give us their best franchise years and play with us if I didn't want them to be successful? Yeah. So when they say, okay, you got a nice little thing going here, it's great, and it kind of took care of, you know, three or four of you guys and a bunch of these other guys, but I want it to be this. Okay, then we're going to support that. So, you know, we form a family office, and this year, speaking of punching above our weight, you know, we formed we're doing a fund for the first time, you know, $50 million fund that got, you know, go out and raise a lot more than we usually raise and put it in a fund and then go buy deals and, you know, punch it above our weight again, you know?
I was going to say, what led to that? And what's the thesis around it? Because that kind of ties into, obviously, you wouldn't be raising a bunch of money and getting all aggressive towards scale if you weren't bullish on what you do, who you're doing it with, who you're doing it for. So talk about the mindset behind that.
Yeah, this might be going on a lot of places. I haven't really talked to too many people in my seat in other markets, but what we saw coming through the pandemic, we'll back up a little bit. Because we're buying existing apartment buildings that have certain characteristics and sit in an ecosystem that are surrounded by certain features and things, we're big on neighborhoods and the stuff around them. It's a long, complicated thing. And then the employment base and, you know, make sure that's spread out, all the stuff. I already know what kind of 50 to 70 buildings, 50 for sure, 70 if I kind of stretch that a little bit, I want to own from, you know, Interstate 5 all the way up the Canadian border, all the way down to maybe, you know, Medford, Oregon. I mean, I already know which ones work. So I can reverse engineer my whole business and say, okay, we should just be talking to those 70 people, the people that own all the time. And a certain number of them are going to come up on the market when they hit, you know, their equity requirement marks or somebody dies or, you know, their debt's due. You know, we know what all the triggers are that might cause that. And we're talking to the brokerage community because they're working those guys too, right? So we already know which ones we want to own. Well, going into this year, we had intel that led us to believe there was going to be a lot more product coming on the market than normal. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it was developers. So developers going in the pandemic, you know, had to finish building their product, but a lot of them were scared to death. And operating these things and grinding them for cash like we do every day is not their thing. They, you know, they're just trying to hit a occupancy mark and, you know, stay in their loan covenants and get this thing done and, you know, make sure there's not, you know, the sheetrock doesn't fall off. So they were in that mode and scared in this pandemic because there was all this, you know, eviction moratorium stuff going on and locking rents and all that. And so we talked to several who were building into these markets and amongst the 70 who said, I'll sell to you at a fixed price if you're willing to take the risk. And then when I deliver this thing to you at 95% occupancy, or when I get it there, then I'll deliver it to you at that number. So we gambled on a few and wound up buying two deals that we put into the fund right out of the gate this spring at a total of about $9 million behind appraised value when we brought them in. So that's why. So we saw a lot more acquisition opportunities coming, and we knew that if we had certainty of capital and enough of it in our hands, we could go get them. So we raised the first 30 of the 50 from kind of the, you know, people that have been doing direct invest with us over the years. And then the last 20 we're going to do in a more kind of traditional external marketing deal where we'll work our referrals and all that. But actually, there's kind of some new frontiers in fundraising that are interesting to talk about that called IAM. It's called Investor Acquisition Marketing, where sort of, you know, group funding is over on one end. You know, that's kind of the
CrowdStreet, all that.
And they do great. Those are really cool. And then way over here is the old school, pick the phone up and, you know, call a guy and see if somebody else will introduce him, you know, to his aunt who's got some money and off you go, right? Mm-hmm. So in the middle are, you know, now everybody's got kind of a digital footprint and a digital signature of some kind. So we can kind of find a hybrid in there where we're directly marketing to people from targeted lists or groups But we have a digital means by which we can reach them that's much more efficient. And then, of course, throws a wide net. And it's pretty efficient. It's if you have the right kind of product, you can do that. So we're
are they like brokerage houses or
no, they're not.
What is an IAM?
Yeah, IAM is just a kitschy marketing term for investor acquisition marketing. There's a lot, and they're all marketing firms. You know, we have to have all the licensing to do what we do, and they understand the business well. A lot of them come from the business, so. But no, we basically, it's kind of the old school way of, you know, finding people for your direct invest program, but enhanced with sort of some digital oomph and then some machine learning that can help you find other people more quickly than you would if you just were trying to, you know, set up lunches and Zoom.
And how are you converting them into the fund?
Yeah. So once you get their attention, then all these outfits do is they're just a warm lead generation machine. You know, once you get a hit on a warm lead, I mean, you got to bring them in, right? So yep. You have to restructure your company a little bit because you might get a lot of leads, which is the point. But so anyway, we're trying some, you know, some things that, you know, we probably could get the 20 done the old way. And we're, you know, we're bringing in about, you know, 500,000 to a million a week, you know, that way. And so if we just want to be patient and, you know, wait till the end of the year, we'll have it. Yeah. But we thought we'd simultaneously try this and see how both go. And so there's some new things out there to raise capital that, you know, are worth looking into. It's pretty new. And it's a little risky in some ways just because it's a new thing, but if it works and we're convinced that, well, if you have the right product and story and track record, you know, those things at the end of the day, you got to have something to sell.
Yeah.
No matter how easy you can get to people now. So that's going on. So, yeah, you know, this history of being a direct invest kind of syndicator, you know, is really put us in a position where we have access to deals in the market that maybe we wouldn't have had, you know, when we started. And I think that is something that, you know, people starting out in syndication and in real estate business who are trying to buy deals and use other people's money as LPs to, you know, fill out the equity round there to go do them, to keep in mind is at the end of the day, this still works on deals. I mean, deals are deals, right? And I don't know why we didn't see this coming, but it took us, we've been at this about 14, 15 years together. It probably took us 5-6 years before we started winning. We were getting invited into, you know, best and final rounds a lot more. We're like, why is that happening? Well, the first 6-8 deals we did, you know, we behaved really well. Everybody knew our underwriting was trusted and good because we came from this operator background. So we're not going to have a big, you know, oh crap, what happened? I missed on this number. I got to retrade the deal. We never retraded deals. Here's our number. Yeah, we might move a little bit into the best and final rounds. And then when we get to the final number, if you pick us, it ain't going to be no retrade. You know, we're going straight to close and we're going to make this experience enjoyable for the broker and the seller and everybody. And we didn't know how else to do it. We just thought that's how you should do it. Turned out that gave us a competitive advantage in some ways.
You end up with a great reputation around town that people want to just keep bringing you deals.
And so that improves your efficacy. It's one thing to have your 60, 70 deals that you like and see a lot more of them coming on the market. So, hey, let's go raise a fund. It's another to actually have a shot at those deals because it's just so competitive and you don't want to overpay, right?
Yeah.
So we've had enough circumstances. We buy some off market like these two developer deals, but you know, a lot of times you just have to go head to head and see something that somebody else doesn't see that gets you the deal. But we've had a few that we bought where we found out afterwards we're not the highest bidder. We were maybe number two by a little bit, but they chose us because they knew we wouldn't retrade it. So access is a big deal. You know, we figured out with LPs we're talking to that if you as a promoter have some sort of unique access, maybe it's just deep market knowledge. So when you make a bet in the market, you really know where the risks and all that are. That gives you a huge advantage with LPs because that market knowledge and access is huge.
Yeah. So as we wrap up, Tom, I know a lot of people are, we'd be doing them a disservice by, you know, not asking about your overall economic outlook going forward and, you know, what risks, what opportunities are out there, things to maybe lean into and get a little bit excited or, you know, explore some aggression around, but also, you know, some of those areas that you want to be careful of the safety traps, you know, and trap doors and build the safety nets in that you need to, you know, navigate some of these choppy waters that oftentimes create some of the best opportunities for people in terms of wealth building and furthering their income and their financial freedom goals.
Yeah, it's complicated to answer. I'll try to do it, you know, really simple. I abandoned a lot of social media and communicating and absorbing information from sources that I just found were distorting my my view of reality. You know, if you read the news, you know, everybody knows what's going on, right? Media is trying to manipulate us to clickbait and all that. Okay, so let's assume everybody knows that there's some issues there. So I pretty much really absorb most of my news about externalities that might be impacting the economy through Wall Street Journal and maybe a deep dive in Barron's or something like that. And then I spend a lot of time, partly because I'm kind of a lazy guy, I don't like to read a lot. Makes me sleep. I call people all the time. So my first bit of advice is I'm going to have an answer on where I think things are today. But I think what's most important for people getting going in real estate or trying to have some consistent success is find a methodology and a process to filter information so you're getting good information. It's just so difficult. One of the things that a lot of the young people I mentor just say, it's just so hard. I don't know what to trust anymore. I agree. So yep. I'll state this too, about 2030-ish, and there's some writing and some theorizing and some research done on this by a couple of guys named Bolio, a couple of brothers that have some depth in this, and some other people that's when this entitlement environment that we've created in the U.S. starts catching up with us. So we just don't have enough revenue to, you know, cover all the baby boomers as they're pulling from the from the tax base, and the tax base isn't that big anymore. So anyway, one or the other has to give. You know, we have to extend the entitlements out. Well, you know, the baby boomers have never not gotten what they wanted. That's just kind of a pathology that's unfortunate. And yeah, maybe there's some good in that too. So we have to watch that issue. And so I think, you know, be ready for a reset, you know, a pretty big reset in the U.S. economy that might cause you to want to be liquid going into about 20, 27, 28. So I just frame everything by saying those things. Like, I have my way of filtering information. It's very focused on trying to get to the truth. And often I'm talking to people who I think are also good at that in different areas to try to get my information. So that's one. And then, you know, there is this looming issue around, you know, US debt that's got to get dealt with, that based on how human beings tend to behave, seeking pleasure and avoiding pain, you know, we'll probably won't fix it through discipline. We'll probably have to go through it. And that will be something that, if you're liquid enough, when things get repriced, you know, it's rough, and a lot of, you know, it's horrible stuff happens at a human level. People lose jobs and houses, and it's awful, you know, but there you stand patriotically digging us out when things get to a bottom and we start revving the engine back up. So that's one. So in the short run, to answer your question more directly, I'm still pretty optimistic about apartments and housing in most of the West Coast and some other parts of the U.S. I don't see us catching up with demand on the supply side for, you know, 10 years or so. I mean, it would take massive political change to change it. You have to have not more than just a Growth Management Act mandate. You have to have change you have to impose. You know, California's trying to do it in its own kind of way, but I mean, you got to have something happen here to get the housing built, because we have this NIMBYism and selfish culture that doesn't want anything built near them once they get their slice of heaven. So that's got to get fixed. And that's not going to happen quickly until we, you know, expunge that pathogen out as it ages out. And people who are young and experiencing high housing costs have faced that reality that the generation ahead hasn't. So that's going to take some time to get through. So I would just be heavy into housing of any kind, really. I think single family building into the market. I think building apartments, if you can do it affordably. That son of mine that's active, he's converting a motel into studio apartments in a small market, but super underserved because they've been supply choked. So I like that category. We're staying out of the cities. I think people need to be a little careful about the cities. I just don't think city life is going to be appealing for a while. It's going to take a while. Still allowing too much crime to happen. Seattle, for example, has got about 60-65% of office occupancy back, but that, you know, last chunk to get it to 80-85 is mostly about perceptions of crime and that kind of stuff. So, and we're not fixing it. Seattle's actually doing a pretty good job. They had a big summer and good tourist season and all that. So maybe they're coming back quicker than others, but we got to get that stuff figured out. So I like your suburbs. I like buying into the notion that we're going to have a lot of hybrid work. And I still like these port cities and port communities that have universities in and around them that tend to be younger on the age side. The externalities that concern me are still that obviously that mess in Europe, the war in Ukraine and what might happen there and mm-hmm. Disruption to markets there. But the forces at play there are pretty big and they're a lot closer to it than us. And so I have a feeling the Europeans and the Ukrainians and Russians are going to come to some settlement there so we don't lose our European buyers. So I can go on, but I'm pretty optimistic generally. I trust human beings to fix macro problems. I don't stay up at night worrying about global warming because I think we're going to figure out how to scrub carbon out of the, out of the atmosphere at some point. It's just chemistry, stuff like that. It doesn't happen fast, but I think we're going to figure a lot of these problems out.
So are you guys going to remain bullish and aggressive on deploying that 50 mil? Continue to operate and do what you guys do. And I know that, you are always looking for ways to innovate and grow and expand. So I'm always curious on where you're looking to challenge yourself.
Well, I didn't say anything about the other categories. The hotel business is coming back. I know you know a lot more about that than I do. I still think office and retail are going to struggle as they kind of find their sweet spot post-COVID and the buying patterns kind of settle into something. We're probably a little oversupplied in those categories still. So we've been in multifamily workforce kind of housing, taking care of, working folk, that wake up every day and go to work for a long time. And it's been pretty steady. And that's probably because it's poor human need, right? Everybody needs a place to hang their hat at night. And so we stick with that. Now, it's got its own kind of low risk, low return story. It's kind of nice. It's the little engine that could, the singles and doubles. That's not for everybody. Portfolios need sometimes more aggressive growth. And so if I were a betting man in that, I'd say, okay, that's fine. I'd take some chances building into that environment. I'd build multifamily or convert hotels, or I'd do all kinds of things to figure out how to get into that undersupplied environment. Cause it's just, I just don't see it getting fixed anytime soon, as long as we don't, destroy the job market somehow. It looks like jobs are going to hold up here for a while. I'm a little concerned about young men. I haven't figured out, our participation rate in the labor force, with young men and the college enrollment numbers are down. There's something going on with men that has my attention right now that I think could be a pathogen that we're going to have to deal with.
It seems like at least in a lot of circles and influencers and leaders and people that I am fortunate to be surrounded by and, kind of gain wisdom, that's a big concern for a lot of them, honestly. Yeah. And I think, ultimately, you've heard a lot of the toxic masculinity talks for quite some time, and these pendulums, and obviously this, is just the truth, liberalism and liberal policy ultimately is what's attacking a lot of these cultural ideologies, we'll just say, in the context of men right now and masculinity and, some of the things that have been staples of America and being a man for such a long time, now really kind of getting attacked and eroded. And so I've been hearing a lot more of that, men, being a lot of people standing up for, I guess, kind of fighting against that dangerous rhetoric, against what ultimately I think innately, I know I can speak for myself, makes me a man and makes me feel like a man. And, some of the other areas of life now, how that could ultimately be a big challenge and painting and foreshadowing a big challenge, or some of the challenges that society is going to face and experience that'll have a massive domino effect in all areas, families, careers, industries, the country as a whole, all of that kind of stuff. I think there's a lot of arguments to be made for it being a real concern right now.
Well, I'm concerned about it for all the reasons you just described, and other people are starting to pay attention to it. I'm on a couple of college boards, and we're looking at trying to figure out where the men, and 70% of high school valedictorians are women, and it's not good. Everybody wants women to be successful. That something changed in out there, and the pandemic was horrible for men, young men especially, and we see all kinds of things, but then back on business, like I have to think about, a 10-year bet in a community around, you know, the people that are going to get up every day and have a job, because that's the only ones I can have as a customer, because mm-hmm. they could pay rent. The people that don't have jobs, I God bless them, but I can't put them in my buildings unless somebody wants to pay their rent for them.
Yep.
Well, that, you know, that seems like something that you would expect, you know, most guys to want. And there's just sort of this thing I'm watching. They were like, man, there's a bunch of them. I don't know how they're going to pay rent. and I'm praying for them, and I'm doing a lot of, you know, direct work, trying to figure it out and get into it. I think a lot of it wouldn't have happened if the pandemic didn't force us into our houses and then keep kids out of school so long. But I want to bring it back and pay attention to it. I think that's a macro force that will take care of itself and maybe get better, but that's going to impact the earning power. Mm-hmm. A whole generation of renters coming up behind the group that are paying us rent today that I'm watching closely. So
what do you say to the person that goes, man, I want to know more about what Tom's doing and what Tom's got going on, and, you know, for them to want to follow a little bit more along or engage with you, your company? How do people get more engaged with you, Tom?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. I'm an open book. I loan my time out a lot more now than I didn't have the time before. You know, we're kind of empty nesters and in that kind of stage of life where, you know, you want to help and mentor others. I don't have anything to sell.
That's what I love about you. You're one of the most generous dudes and honestly wise and successful, but just humble guys out there. And I think, you know, my wife and I were talking about this yesterday, because we were talking about a lot of the things you and I talk about, right? And just concerns that we have for us, our kids, you know, future generations, all the things that I think everybody is concerned about and worried about ultimately deep down inside. We're, you know, outside of the fringe on the right and the fringe on the left, like most of us all share many of the same similar, logical, reasonable concerns. And it all, you know, ultimately seems to rise and fall on leadership. Within ourselves, leadership within our families, leadership and ownership in our careers, and being accountable to good values and things like that, right? So I just want to acknowledge you for every time you and I have connected, gotten on the phone, all the times you've offered and lend an ear and, you know, opportunities and wisdom and resources. It's greatly appreciated. And I want to say thank you for coming on and sharing some of that with the Millionaire Mindcast community today. So we'll be sure to link up all of that stuff. If you're a high net worth investor and you want to check out, you know, a credit investor, and you want to check out some of the great deals that Tom has. I mean, if people always say, you know, how do I get into good syndication opportunities? And of course, I'm always, you know, sharing and pitching my own deals, but I've looked at so many different operators, so many different deals, and, you know, people that don't have anywhere close to the track record and resume that you do. So if you are, you know, an accredited investor and want to take a look at different deals, what's the best way for them to kind of get on your deals list?
Yeah, I'm easy to find if you just search on Google Hoban Family Office or Tom Hoban. There are a couple other Tom Hobans, but I'm the one up in the Pacific Northwest. Yeah, the bearded wonder now or whatever I am. Yeah. And and our company's names are Coast. Sometimes we show up under Coast Group, and I'm easy to find there and reach out. People can always, you know, email me and find me through you. We'd love to take care of anybody who wanted to do exactly the sort of investing that we offer, but I definitely want to, you know, endorse you and the work you're doing. What's in it for me that this is about and the other work that I'm trying to do to support others is we need more Matt Atchisons. We need more ethical leadership. This marketplace got really disrupted and we got a lot of, you know, influence on it. And, you know, the more good people operating in the marketplace, all marketplaces, the better more people will be. I'm a big believer in the marketplace as a place for mostly good to happen, but you have to have good ethical leaders that have a humble servant leader style to them. So you keep grinding, man. Anybody want to reach out? That's great. But
we'll link all that up.
What you're doing all day long,
and,
bro.
And all I'll say is, you know, getting that tailwind. You know, when you get great mentors and great people behind you. I mean, I can say that from when you and I first connected, you know, almost 2 years ago to today, my net worth has grown a couple million. I have grown as a leader. I've grown as a business owner. I've had many failures along the way. But, you know, when you get around people and conversations and environments that inspire you and challenge you and get you thinking bigger and giving you, you know, some of the stepping stones to get there, you know, you gotta give thanks for that. And, that's why I'm grateful for a Tom Hoban. And, I know the Millionaire Mindcast family is as well. So thanks for coming on the show today, man.
Appreciate you.
Well, that wraps up this week's episode. Hopefully you guys enjoyed that interview. And if you did, all I ask is that you share it with somebody else who maybe needs to hear this today, or that could gain some value from something that was talked about or discussed in today's interview. You just never know, one piece of information, a conversation, a tool, a resource can completely transform and change the trajectory of someone's life or their business. So if you get any kind of value or you want to support the show, all we ask is that you help us organically get this in front of more people. Also, for those of you who are really looking to accelerate your wealth building journey and unlock more financial freedom, get more time back, and just level up your life, your business, your finances, be sure to head over to therichlifeacademy.com to check out all the amazing products and resources that we offer to our Millionaire Mindcast family, whether that's one-on-one coaching with me, courses from our guests, all kinds of free content, downloads, checklists, upcoming event info, and how you can connect with us live in person, all kinds of great valuable tools. You can get that over at therichlifeacademy.com. Last but not least, I always want to know, who do you guys want to hear me interview next? Let me know. Shoot me a text at 844-447-1555. With that being said, until next time, keep investing in yourself and your wealth on your march to a million and beyond. Cheers, my friend.